Happy Bat New Year, everybody, and welcome to the first Batman Nightcast episode of 2026. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
And we've got two great tales of the Dark Knight Detective this episode. We're continuing our coverage of last year's Batman and Robin Year One, but before that, we're going to scratch our itch for Poison Ivy with the first half of a two-part story from Legends of the Dark Knight, issue 42. First, though, Happy New Year, Chris.
Happy New Year, Ryan.
Thanks. The last time we recorded was before the Christmas holiday, and I gotta ask, did you get any bat-themed presents under your tree this year?
I did, of course, because I have a very loving family who knows me very well, and they know that, if there's one thing I for sure that I want for Christmas, it's Batman stuff. So I got the, most importantly for our purposes, I have not started reading them yet, but I do have the Batman novels based on the 89 Michael Keaton films by John Jackson Miller that you've been raving about. I got both of those for Christmas. So I'm going to start reading those. The only reason I haven't yet is I was reading the Marshall Rogers book from Tomorrows.
Nice.
By Jeff Messer and Dewey Castle. And it's Brightest Days and Darkest Nights. And it's a great book. As always, the Tomorrows books are always great. This is no exception. And it's about, one of my favorite Batman artists, Marshall Rogers. So. And our friend Dan Greenfield actually interviews Steve Englehart. They put into print his interviews with him from 13thdimension.com. So that's a cool bit in there as well. I got the Corgi Batboat reissue, the large one from the 60s in, reproduction box and all that. I have the Batmobile already, got it last year. And I got a few other Batman figures. I got the Batman Year 2 figure based on McFarlane's art from McFarlane Toys and a few other Batman toys here and there. But yeah, so I got a vintage Batman and Robin puzzle with art by Dick Giordano. So I got plenty of Batman stuff for Christmas. What about you?
Nope. Angie said that she requested a list for me, like a Christmas list, because like her dad, my mom, other people wanted to know what to get me for Christmas. So I made an Amazon shopping list complete with links to like four books or comics or like trades and stuff like that. Like like give me these. That's all I need. Here's my shopping list. I got none of them.
Oh my gosh.
Like, the four things I specifically asked for from people who specifically asked me what I wanted for Christmas, got none of them. So, we had two different Christmases, and when we left the second one, I just told Angie, I was like, don't get me presents anymore. I just get stuff for Reese. I don't need this. I don't need the expectation for this. I buy myself my favorite things anyway, so I don't want to. I'm not doing this anymore. So.
Right. If you're not going to get what you want, then I understand that. Yeah. I get asked by, Cindy, give me a Christmas list. And she doles it out amongst, the family. And I mean, of course, she gets me some and Andrew and Danny give me some. But then like my dad and my sister, she tells them, Chris wants this. So like one of the John Jackson Miller books came from my dad and like, the DVD set of the Thriller series hosted by Boris Karloff came from my mother-in-law. Well, she wouldn't have known to buy that if Cindy hadn't said, this is what he wants. Of course, Cindy's mother also gets me, always gets me cologne and, house slippers when I don't wear cologne and I don't need house slippers. I've got a pair, but that's fine. But it's the thought that counts. But yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah, I got to say, they come through pretty well. I gotta give them credit. So,
it sounds like it. I'm very happy for you. Two of the things on my list were the Batman and Robin Year One collection, and the other one was the Sandman Mystery Theater Compendium Volume 2, which collects the second half of the series that I'll be getting to with Paul and Max eventually on our podcast. So, yeah, I'll have to buy them for myself. So, and I will.
I feel like that second one we should be that should come out of the Fire and Water Slush Fund. You know, I think you all three of you should get a copy of that just for podcasting purposes. You know, and Batman and Robin, you're one too. Honestly, you know, so we can make a case for that. Yeah,
I'll submit that request. We'll see if that can be approved.
Robin Shag will be the giant floaty heads that say guilty. No, you know some.
Well, all of that sounds awesome. I'm curious about the Marshall Rogers biography. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, the only thing I will say, my minor critique of it, I wish there was more Batman art in it. I mean, there's still Batman art in it, but I feel like there's a lot of it's mostly focusing on him being like one of the great Batman artists, and there's not a lot of Batman art from him that I haven't already seen. And I know there's plenty of sketches and things that he did over the years that are posted online that show up, you know, at auction sites and things like that. I'd like to have seen more of that in the book.
Oh yeah,
you know, but I mean, it's still visually a good looking book, but that's my minor critique of it. I just wish there was a little more Batman content visually, but I mean, the whole book's almost about him, you know, I'd say a good 75-80% of the book's about his work on Batman. So, you know, can't complain too much.
Other Batman related news. First, I need to give a shout out, a really quick plug, to another podcaster, Mike Garvey from the Waiting for Doom duo. He with Paul Hicks, and they've done other shows in the past, including the DC OCD podcast and the Gary Show. Mike is back now with a solo podcast dedicated to Batman called The Detective Phase. Shout out to somebody in our group who thinks Batman is just a phase for people. But The Detective Phase is because Mike collects and has a pretty deep and established collection specifically of just detective comics, Batman's Adventures in Detective. So he's going to start covering some of those. He has a Zero episode, that kind of the introduction one, and then he just released Episode 1, which is just like a short 20-minute episode about Batman's first appearance in Detective 27. Quick little reviews and then kind of analysis and thoughts on them. Really cool, really incisive. Mike is funny. It's a fun show if you can stand the crazy Aussie accent.
Oh, that sounds good. I haven't listened to that yet. I enjoy Mike's humor with Paul and their analysis and their shows are always very, very fun. So I'll look forward to that. It makes me feel like he's kind of doing what Andy Leyland did with Amazing Spider-Man, which is awesome. So that's great. I'm down for that.
Beyond that, I'm trying to think of some other Batman-related news. We got some casting news for The Batman Part 2, which they say is in development. They're taking their time. It's been a minute. But is it confirmed or is it like unofficially confirmed? But they're saying Sebastian Stan has been cast and they're saying that he's playing Harvey Dent. Has that been like confirmed by official channels or is that just still...
Who knows what's confirmation, you know, on the internet nowadays is. I mean, it was floated around and then it was like, yes, Sebastian Stan is playing Harvey Dent. But I still don't know if Warner Brothers or Matt Reeves have ever said, yes, Sebastian Stan's playing Harvey Dent. Because as far as I know, they've never said who Scarlett Johansson's playing either. I mean, there's a lot of speculation that she's Andrea Beaumont, but now people are wondering if she isn't Gilda or Grace Dent, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
Whichever they want to call Harvey's wife in this. So, I don't know. And some people are, with him playing Harvey Dent, people are like, is this going to be a long Halloween movie? And I'm like, well, I hope they fix the plot of that because it doesn't make any sense at the end. But, you know,
if she is playing Harvey's wife, whether they call her Gilda or Grace or something else, there's no other reason to cast an actress of ScarJo's talent and how much they have to pay her unless she would be playing Holiday or something, some form of the Holiday Killer. So,
right.
Like, if that's who she's playing, it kind of has to be that story because
yeah, exactly.
They're not going to have her just be the wife from, like, the Two-Face animated series two-parter. As great as that episode was, possibly the best episode of Batman the Animated Series, but it's still like you don't get ScarJo for that role. You get her for something serious, which is why I thought maybe her being Andrea Beaumont would be a great pick.
Yeah, I'd rather, I'm not sure I'd rather see her as Andrea Beaumont, honestly, than because that way she can also be the Phantasm, you know. So
did they say, I don't remember if they've said or like if they've talked about like the villains in this movie or like somebody that we've never seen in a Batman movie or something before, because, and this will get to one of the things that we're talking, like, if they had a new version of Poison Ivy in this movie, I think that would be awesome, because the Uma Thurman version from Batman and Robin was a version of Poison Ivy. I think they could do another one, a different take. They've done it certainly enough with the Riddler and the Joker and Penguin and others, so.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously ScarJo would make a great Poison Ivy, you know.
Absolutely, so. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Any other news? I know they're making a Batman Nightfall animated movie or two-parter, I think, or maybe three-parter. I don't
know. I hadn't even heard that. I just saw this in your notes, and I'm like, oh, really? I didn't know that. So I have really lost track of the DC animated movies. I didn't even know they were doing them anymore. I thought they'd...
I don't know if it's like the same production team, like the people involved in the old ones. I don't know if it's that or if it's like they've basically created a new DC animated thing to be more in line with the current DC studios that James Gunn is heading. So I would expect this wouldn't have like Bruce Timm or Andrea Romano or any of the old guard involved, but I also don't know that at all.
Yeah.
It's just speculation.
Yeah, and I mean, I know there's been several different regime changes over the course of those movies because, I mean, there was, you know, they were kind of Bruce Timm and some of those guys were involved in the beginning, but they didn't really look like the DCAU stuff. And then some of the people that were involved with Young Justice, you know, kind of seemed to take over. And those designs were kind of used at the beginning. And then everybody got really weird shoulders and those weird neck muscles that go into their shoulders and for like about 10 movies. And then they changed it to an even different art style when they did that. I think that started with the Superman Man of Tomorrow movie or whatever, or whatever it was. I can't remember, but, and then it ended with that Crisis, three-parter. I have completely lost track of all of those. I mean, it's kind of bad because I did a JLU cast. You think I'd be up on all the DC animated stuff, but I just like, it just became white noise at some point, and I was just kind of like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So
anything else Batman related?
I have not heard, you know, anything. I think as far as the Batman, I'm hearing that the Joker will be in this film, which might also the Joker that they introduced at the end of the Batman, who has more to do in the deleted scenes, that's played by what's his name? I can't think of the actor's name that was in the Eternal.
I don't know how to pronounce it. Barry Keoghan or Keown?
Barry Keoghan. I guess he's going to come back as the Joker. That's the rumor. And if that might also point to them doing the Long Halloween, too. So, you know, I don't know. Or Mask of the Phantasm, because he's in that, obviously. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I was surprised at how much I liked the Batman, so... I am looking forward to the Batman Part 2 as much as I'm looking forward to any other, you know, DC movie. So.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, by the time they get this done, Robert Pattinson will be every bit as old as Michael Keaton was when he first played Batman. I mean, seriously.
Exactly. I mean, all the complaints about him from the first time around, it's like, those don't apply now.
No, I mean, he's going to be old enough to play the Dark Knight Returns version of Batman if they want to, you know, so... Yeah.
All right, folks. Well, we are going to get into the first of the two comics that we are talking about this time around. On our Christmas episode, we covered a book from Legends of the Dark Knight, and we're sticking with that series, but going back a few issues earlier. We're talking about Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, issue 42. This one had a cover date of February 1993 with an on-sale date of January 12th, 1993. The cover by P. Craig Russell shows Batman in what looks to be a greenhouse surrounded by leaves. His spread cape looks even more like wings than normal. Also, there is blood dripping onto the plants from somewhere above. Chris, what do you think about this cover?
I really think this is a very striking cover. I love the blood red coloring on Batman and the fact that, you know, there's blood dripping. It's very vampiric. It's a really, I mean, I remember this, like, I was buying every Legends of the Dark Knight at this point, but I felt like, ooh, you know, and it was P. Craig Russell, so I'm like, ooh, this is this is pretty, this is going to be good, and I really like the colors and the presentation.
I do too, I do too. The wings, the cape, that whole thing is interesting. I'm trying to think of what it reminds me of.
I'll tell you what it reminds me of. I don't know if you know this, but there was a vampire bat toy made by Mattel in the late 70s, early 80s called Grigory or Gregory, but it was like G-R-E hyphen G-O-R-Y, so it was Grigory.
Okay.
And he had a transparent abdomen that you could pump blood through. You squeezed him, and like you could see blood pumping through him. And he was a big rubber bat. And I think it was the same mechanism they used for an action figure they called Pulsar a few years before. But a friend of mine had that. He was like a blood red colored bat, and he had blood running through him. So that's what this reminds me of.
I don't know if I've ever heard of that.
There's a comic book ad for it. I know it ran in, I think, at least Marvel Comics of the time back then. So, yeah, you might have to look that up. But, yeah, my friend had that. That thing was heavy, too. I mean, you could club somebody with that sucker. He was heavy.
Actually, now I'm thinking, I mean, the depiction of Batman looks nothing like it, but, like, the wings, the inking of them sort of remind me of Kelly Jones. Like,
yeah.
Kelly Jones Batman.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah, his ears aren't nearly long enough, but yeah.
Right. The like the head, the shape, everything, a bit like that is nothing like Kelly Jones, but the wings and that kind of, that it, and maybe it's just like the fact that blood is dripping. It reminds me of Red Rain or something like that. That's probably what helped put that in my mind.
That's true. Yeah.
All righty. Hot House Part 1 is written by John Francis Moore with art by P. Craig Russell, letters by Bill Pearson, and colors by Laverne Kinzerski. Archie Goodwin edited the book. Bruce Wayne is visiting Gotham University when the school's regent, Ian Spencer, climbs out his office window and stands precariously on a ledge. As Spencer's colleagues gape in shock, Bruce slips away to don his Batman disguise. He approaches Spencer on the edge, getting close enough to hear the man's drugged ravings about a woman. Despite Batman's efforts to save him, Ian Spencer plummets to his death. In the aftermath, Batman recognizes a particular woman in the crowd and later tells Captain Gordon it was Pamela Isley. Batman ran afoul of Isley before. At the time, she called herself Poison Ivy. She was crazy in love with Batman, but her touch was deadly. Batman's convinced Ivy is responsible for Ian Spencer's death, but Gordon reminds him that she completed her psychiatric rehabilitation. Batman confronts Pamela in her greenhouse. She insists that she's no longer infatuated with him, and the chemical imbalance that made her dangerous has been corrected. Her touch will no longer affect Batman. The Dark Knight hopes she's telling the truth. Batman investigates Spencer and finds his private safe full of cash and vials of some liquid. At the Batcave, he runs a battery of tests on the substances, but he's too distracted to make any connections from the data. Too distracted by thoughts of Ivy. When the bat signal lights the sky, Batman goes to GCPD headquarters to meet Gordon. Except it's Pamela Isley who lit the signal. She tells Batman that Ian Spencer brought her to Gotham University after her rehab. They became lovers, but Spencer found out she'd created a powerful mind-altering drug called Eden Spring. Spencer told a criminal named Dominique Alioso about Eden Spring, and they hatched a plan to sell the drug after forcing Pamela to make more. Batman tracks down Dominique and her boyfriend Victor, confirms their plan to distribute Eden Spring, and captures them for the police. Later, Bruce Wayne slips away from his date to call Pamela and tell her that her story checked out. Bruce's date storms out after he calls her Pamela several times. Back at the greenhouse, Poison Ivy reveals that the murder of Spencer and the arrest of his partners was part of her plan, and that Batman is now under her control. Alrighty, what'd you think about this one?
I thought this was a really good one. I haven't read this since it was released. This is one of the better arcs from that early era of Legends of the Dark Knight, where they were all pretty good. You know, they were all good. You know, the first few years of the book, was, especially when Archie Goodwin was editing it, but was really good. I did have one thought when you were reading that synopsis. I wonder if we don't see that panel, but I wonder if Batman answered the bat signal and Ivy walked out instead of Gordon. I wonder if he told her the bat signal is not a beeper.
I was thinking the same thing.
Sorry, a little Batman Forever humor there.
You know what? When it's Nicole Kidman saying that with that push-up dress and everything, you answer the call, damn it.
Damn it. Why wasn't she? I'm nothing against Uma Thurman, but she should have been Poison Ivy.
Nothing against Uma Thurman, indeed, but a lot of other people might have been better suited for that role. Yeah, this was an interesting one, and I was looking for a Poison Ivy story. I was looking for something kind of short because we needed like two issues to set up because we're going to do something else special for episode 50. Spoilers, folks. And I found this one. I thought this one was a good fit, but this is a story earlier in the time. So, I mean, the story is set up as if it's like their second encounter with Poison Ivy. So it would slot in sometime after her first appearance, but before anything else more modern than that. I thought it was interesting because at this point they're still very much playing with that the idea of, you know, men being drawn to her, being infatuated with her because of her seductive touch and falling under her spell. But at this point she is still kind of in that mood of she loves Batman or she doesn't love him, and it's a little bit, that's kind of her downside, her weakness is, you know, she's obsessed with the hero, and they've certainly taken that, you know, that weakness away from her in modern depictions, as in the 90s and then 2000s, they started exploring her as more of a bisexual or pansexual character. And now I think she's just full on lesbian involved with Harley Quinn or other female characters. But I still like the whole idea. Like this is an artifact of a particular time for that character, where the romantic and sexual dynamic between her and Batman, even though it was corrupt and twisted, was still a little bit mutual. And I just find that kind of an interesting story to explore.
Yeah, that's true. It's that was like kind of an element every time she showed up. And I know that they explored that in the Secret Origins issue that you covered. And did we cover? I think we covered that with you. Did we cover, me and Cindy cover that with you on Secret Origins, or am I crazy? I think we did. Maybe. I know I listened to it. I don't know if I was on it. It's been so long ago. I don't know. But I remember you covered it. And it's like that was part of it, too, you know, that she was infatuated with Batman. They kept that, you know, and they like amped it up to being almost more of like she was psychologically, like, you know, like she was crazy with it, you know.
Right.
So and not to, you know, use a pejorative there, but I mean, like, that's the quickest way to say that. So. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting too. Yeah, she's changed a lot, you know, and she's not controlling plants, and she's not basically like a female Swamp Thing, you know, like she is nowadays, you know. So yeah,
and she's also she has become one of my favorite Batman rogues over the last couple of years, and part of it is just like I've always sort of bristled against the idea of like villains getting their own books or their own series and everything. That's one of several reasons why I stayed away from the Harley Quinn animated series for so long. When I finally did, I was like, oh, this is amazing. I love this. And Poison Ivy is great in that show too. But also like villain centric comic book series, I kind of stayed away from, but I've read a bunch of the current or the more recent Poison Ivy series. And I do dig it. I like a lot about it. But she's become one of these, like, how do I want to say it? Do you remember, like, in the 2000s, there was a whole thing of, like, Magneto was right, that thing that kind of spun off of, like, the Grant Morrison run on New X-Men, and sort of positing him as this, you know, a political figure with a kind of social progressive idea that was, you know, he was always seen as the villain because he wanted to retaliate against mankind, whereas Charles proposed a more peaceful coexistence, but they kept being betrayed more and more to the point where it's like, okay, you're not going to find peace. You're going to have to, if you want to save your people, you're going to have to fight back.
Yeah.
And I was always of this mindset. I was like, nope, Magneto is the villain. White Queen, Emma Frost is the villain.
Yeah.
Poison Ivy is the villain. And I just, I tried to have that clear, simplistic delineation of good and evil, black and white. And as I've grown older, I can't, the way I see these as environmental issues, things having to do with race, ethnicity, the environment, the globe. I can't pretend anymore. It's like, yeah, I mean, you can call her an environmental terrorist, but I wouldn't shed a tear if a few more, you know, CEOs were killed off to save the planet for my children. It's like, I don't consider her such a bad guy after all. And that's just kind of one of those things. So when I see the Magneto's t-shirt, I used to think that was like edgelord stupid. And I'm like, I think I might be more on Magneto's side than Xavier's at this point. Sorry.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, I think she and Magneto are characters you can get behind that more. Because I think even when they were portrayed as villains, in the best stories, the heroes kind of realized they did have a point. You know, it wasn't... I do think there's way too much emphasis nowadays on you know, how many times have they tried to... Well, Lex Luthor's in the Justice League. I do not want that, man. I don't care who's writing it. Right. I don't care how well you're writing it. It's like, let's not put Lex in the Justice League. I don't want Lex Luthor to be right. He is wrong about Superman, you know, but Poison Ivy and Magneto, they got a point, you know? So, I'm with you there. I think there's way too many writers that want to indulge making the villains the anti-heroes or just the heroes. And then it neuters your actual heroes, because then they're like, well, now your heroes are completely lame. But I think, like you said, I agree that Poison Ivy is a character that you can do that with and get mileage out of. And it doesn't feel forced or wrong. It feels like a natural evolution of the character and, you know, our recognizing, you know, in society what's going on more and more and relating it to the comic stories.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I love on page 2, the top 3 panels, that little thing kind of has it. You see it almost like cinematically, like panning across the crowd of spectators as they see this guy about to jump. And we get Bruce in the middle of him recognizing it. And then Bruce in the third one running through the crowd as we see him kind of slipping away to change into the costume. So I like that little that triptych.
Yeah, that's a nice touch. Yeah, the whole scene up front. At the beginning with Ian and he looks a little bit like Joey Pants with less hair or without his toupee on the first in the first panel on page 1. Yeah, he does to me, with, you know, but I like how he's got the swirly purple in his eye to show that he's, you know, been mesmerized. He's been drugged.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's this whole sequence is nice, and it's pretty brutal. I honestly don't know why Batman thought this guy was alive when he got down to him, because the panel, the splash page looks like dude's dead. I mean, the way his head's in the pavement and there's blood everywhere, it's like, if that guy's alive, you know, I'd be real surprised, right? You know, so.
I love that splash page for like that being front and center, but we've also got like is it surrounded by the ivy leaves as they sort of get darker and kind of fade into black for the title. And then... We have a quote from Alfred Lord Tennyson on the, and it's, "And most of all would I flee from the cruel madness of love, the honey of poison, flowers, and all the measureless ill." I heard an interview with the writer Dan Slott one time where he was just kind of mentioning that in the wake of Watchmen, every comic writer tried to have a quotation, a famous literary quote or a poetic verse or a lyric in the beginning of their comic, because that would make it feel important. And he would like trick people into thinking, oh, this is a sophisticated comic because I'm quoting, you know, Lord Byron at the beginning or something.
Right. Yeah. That was definitely like, comics are not for kids. They're legitimate literature. Pay attention to us. You know? Yeah. I mean, that was a cry for that in almost every book that was trying to be more than just your average superhero slugfest. Yeah, I, you know, John Francis Moore is a name that I'm familiar with, but I'm like, okay, what else has he written that I've read? And then I go and look at his CV on like Mike's Amazing World, and I'm like, oh, well, he wrote the 90s Superboy series at first, that the 80s Superboy series based on the TV show. He wrote Doom 2099. He wrote Kronos, which are things I all read at least the first several issues of, you know, and enjoyed. And so it's like, oh, okay, he got around a lot. He was pretty prolific in this period. It doesn't seem like he's done much in a long time in comics. But, yeah, it's a name I recognize, but I couldn't, off the top of my head, say what he had done. But now I'm like, okay. I have read a lot of his stuff.
Kind of the same thing for P. Craig Russell. They're almost like the equivalent of those like veteran character actors that you see in a movie or show. You're like, oh, I know that guy. I've seen that guy in something. And then you check out their IMDb. It's like, oh, this person is in everything. but I don't know their name. I can never remember the name.
Right. So, yeah, yeah. P. Craig Russell was kind of always like on the periphery of, I think he was like one of those artists that was admired a lot by his peers. And I mean, he had his fans but he didn't, he inked a lot of stuff on bigger books, but you know, he also did a lot of independent stuff. He did the Elric adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
He was big in that. He drew two issues of Batman Family that Paul and Sean covered on their show, Batman Family Reunion, which I had. And he had just done the Robin 3000 miniseries before this, which I don't remember much about other than he drew it. And it was set in the future and Robin was blonde. That's really all I remember about it.
Well, I don't accept that.
Okay.
At the end of that scene, I like how they frame the sequence of Batman recognizing Ivy in the crowd, that kind of close up, and it's like someone who should not be here. And then when he recognizes her, first you see his eyes get huge with recognition, and then there's that really close up shot of just like her eyes and her lips that goes almost black and white, but for the green hue of it, and her saying Batman, and then kind of like just the effect of the way that name kind of gets distorted after that. And then it's like Batman, like the cops on the scene are trying to get his attention. I really like the way that effect was kind of captured to show he almost like is like just triggered by her appearance and going into a different place. That's a little bit distracting for him.
Yes. I like that too. I feel like there are probably strange stirrings in his utility belt too. Yeah. So,
innuendo.
Yeah.
I like when the Batman's in Gordon's office when he's sitting in the windowsill about to like leap out and everything like that. I like just how he's sort of squatting with like his knees bent and he's on the toes of his feet. He looks more like lithe and skinny. He just has like a more of an angular, lean build to him, which I appreciate because it does remind me more of the Neil Adams and Marshall Rogers kind of thinner Batman than we're kind of used to seeing with the more muscled and kind of like just a bulky version that we got for a while.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he in some ways, and even though he goes for like a leathery effect a lot, you know, that's kind of Mazzucchelli-like in some ways, it is more like a Bronze Age Batman build, and the way his cape works sometimes, and you know, and the where he's that long panel where he's like a suggestion, Captain. It's like everything's just blue. He looks very Bronze Age-y Batman right there. So yeah, but he drew Batman in the Bronze Age, so you know.
True enough. The Batman Family ones that you mentioned.
Right.
Before.
Right. Yeah.
From there, we get the scene where he approaches her in her greenhouse. You never meet the enemy on their turf. I like the sort of split of her approaching him sort of cautiously, cut to like what he remembers of her, and they're surrounded in like the field of roses, and she's got the leafy bodysuit on, and she's throwing herself at him, and his hands are kind of out. He's like, ah. But yeah, I like this whole little scene, and then he's leaving, and then is he gets a seed of doubt planted in his mind, or is it some other feeling kind of still to be determined?
Yeah, and she gives him a rose, which, you know,
mm-hmm.
That might play into something later. I don't know. We'll see. You know, I haven't read part two again yet, so.
How is the Seal song "Kiss from a Rose" not saved from the Poison Ivy movie and not the one before that?
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah.
That doesn't make sense for the movie with Two-Face and the Riddler.
Yeah, I didn't make any sense. No. I think that Dominique is... I was trying to figure out... At first I thought, is she based on Jeanette Kahn? But I think she might be based on Jill Thompson of Scary Godmother. And, you know, she worked on Wonder Woman. Because she looks... Especially... I'm jumping ahead, but at the end when she's making this face at Batman when he busts her, that looks like Jill Thompson. That looks like her Scary Godmother character, who also looks like her. That looks like the character that Alex Ross cast her as in Kingdom Come. So I'm feeling like that Jill Thompson was the model or the inspiration for Dominique. I don't know what that says about Jill Thompson, but hopefully Pete Kirk Russell and her were friends. But it's like, is that how you're going to treat your friends?
I certainly don't know if you would want to depict Jeanette Kahn that way.
No, probably not. No.
Not if you wanted more work.
That's true, yeah. Because she, you know, she's a criminal and she slapped, the fact that she slaps Ivy, you know, is like, wow. It's like, you know, you're used to, I mean, Poison Ivy being a very dominant character, you know, never subservient, you know. So that's like, wow, that was kind of shocking reading it again. It's like, ooh, you know, so.
Although I did kind of like it speaks to the whole thing, like at the end of that animated series episode, Harley and Ivy, when she's like, no man will ever take us prisoner. And it's Renee Montoya who ends up busting that. It's like,
yeah,
her powers work on men. They have no, a woman has no problem slapping her across the face.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But oddly enough, in modern comics, all three of those characters don't care about men. They're all lesbian characters right now. So it's kind of funny, you know. It's like, well, okay.
When we're in the Batcave and Bruce is trying to read the data and he's still like kind of going over the case and everything, and Alfred's trying to get his attention and he has to basically like shout to get Bruce's attention. We've seen this before, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, here recently in Batman Year One, Batman Robin Year One, yeah. Yeah, Pete Craig Russell's Bruce Wayne looks like Tarzan. He kind of looks like the old Bern Hogarth Tarzan to me. You know, it's kind of interesting, yeah.
Bruce is just monologuing, reading the case files, and Alfred's just like, the signal is lit, and Batman is just kind of brushing past it. He's thinking, but he's distracted by Ivy, and then he's just like, did you say the signal is lit? And he's like, yes, sir. He's like, you should have said something earlier. Alfred's just sighs, like, of course I should have, sir.
I feel like that's kind of a Michael Keaton-y Batman thing, where he's so distracted, you know, his Bruce Wayne is so distracted, and Michael Goff is just like... you know, with him. So I felt this could be very much the 89 Batman right here.
Oh, I would have liked to see Michael Keaton in the Poison Ivy movie. So
yeah, me too. Yeah, I'd like to see Michael Keaton in all those movies.
Yeah.
Nothing against Val Kilmer. I still like Val Kilmer, but I'd still rather see Michael Keaton just continue as Batman.
Hey, you can picture him and you can hear his voice when you read those two books.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
How about this take on the Batmobile?
Yeah, is he playing War's Lowrider as he comes in? You know, I mean, because it's got the hydraulics. You know, it's lifted up. It's like the Bat Tank plus the Michael Keaton Batmobile, like had a baby or something. I don't know. It's pretty wild.
And I think this is a little much for two people, like a man and woman in business suits selling drugs. It's like, come on, you're not going into a war zone. This isn't the Gotham equivalent of Fallujah, dude. Just tone it down. You could have just popped out of the shadows and punched them.
Maybe P. Craig Russell was like, can you write a sequence for the Batmobile? I really have a cool design for the Batmobile I want to use. And John Francis Moore's like, yeah, I mean, well, I guess he can, instead of coming through the skylight or, you know, sneaking out of the shadows, he can just bust through the wall in the Batmobile, I guess, you know.
And we get the whole thing, as you mentioned, like when he takes them down and she, Dominique, kind of goes crazy.
Yeah.
And despite how effortlessly it seems to capture these two, they're not going away. We will get them again in part two of this story. But then we cut away, and it's interesting because we don't see Batman, but we get Bruce Wayne calling Ivy, but he's clearly in, like, he tells her, you know who this is, so he's probably, you can imagine him doing the Batman voice when he's on the phone.
Right. In a public restaurant, you know, I mean, like...
In a public restaurant, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would not work for Christian Bale to do that, no. You know? You know who this is? Dominic and Victor in jail for Spencer's murder. You know, I mean, that's not gonna... People are like, what is wrong? Bruce, what is... Bruce, have you got a cold? What is wrong with you? Yeah, I'm like,
waiter, I asked for the salad dressing on the side.
Yeah. Swear to me, this is Local Ranch, you know? Sorry.
And of course this Bruce Wayne calls his date the wrong name. Oh. Classic rookie mistake, buddy.
Woo. Yeah, she throws wine on. Well, I guess she doesn't throw it. She gets up and it spills on him, so she doesn't actively toss it at him, which, you know, she probably should have, you know.
Yeah. So overall, what did you think?
I like it. It's a great setup. It's an intriguing, I think it's an intriguing take on Poison Ivy. It's, you know, the animated series did that a few times where they're like, well, like the episode House and Garden, where it seemed like Ivy had settled down and married and had stepkids. And oh my God, that's the creepiest damn episode of Batman, the animated series ever. Oh my God. That is so creepy. Yeah. God, jeez. So dark. I mean, bah. But but yeah, it's you know, I that was probably after this, I would think. But yeah, it's a nice, I always like it when, you know, it's an old trope with the Batman villains. The Penguin has reformed now, which Penguin has reformed 150,000 times, and now Poison Ivy has reformed. But it's an interesting take on it. I like it.
Yeah, this was, I mean, I wanted a Poison Ivy story, and this is a different kind of Ivy story than the more modern takes that we're maybe more familiar with. And also from an era of Batman comics, a sort of forgotten one, this, you know, third tertiary or fourth tier Batman book from the 90s that we probably would have skipped over in most cases. So I'm not sure how many of our listeners will actually be familiar with this story, but it is available digitally if you have a DC Infinite. I don't actually know if this has been collected in any trades. That would surprise me if it has been.
Yeah, it's just a two-parter. Yeah.
But it's a fun story, and we'll be back in February to cover the second part of that one. So.
Yep, looking forward.
And also, I don't know like when we're ever going to talk about this creative team either, like either P. Craig Russell or John Francis Moore, but I thought it was, you know, nice to get some new names into the show.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is a hidden gem if you haven't. I mean, we're not done with it yet, but I highly recommend that you check it out so far. I remember it ending well. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to reading the second part and talking about it next time.
All right, folks, we are going to take a promotional break, but when we come back, Chris is going to tell you a little something about Batman and Robin.
An heroic legacy beginning in 1941 that spans time, space, and the whole of the multiverse. Journey along with the Knights of the Stars. Ted, David, and Jack. They, along with Will Payton, Michael Thomas, Prince Gavin, Tom Calore, and Courtney Whitmore. They take the mantle of Starman and continue his legacy. I invite you to listen as I journey through these adventures of all these heroes and the rest of the Starman family here on Opal City Confidential, a Starman podcast, coming February 2023.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to cover Batman and Robin, year one, number four, continuing our coverage of this series. We start out with the cover, the main cover, because, you know, it's a modern comic, so there's 15,000 variant covers. But the main cover is by Chris Samnee, and it shows Batman and a disgruntled Robin standing in front of the bat signal. What do you think of this?
I love the composition. I love the layout and like the way they're posed and everything, especially with the bat signal being so bright that like Batman's cape is so, his cowl is almost kind of vanishing into it. Again, I keep drawing visual comparisons to things that Mazzucchelli did in Batman Year One, which is obviously intentional. I mean, we like at this point, it's not a coincidence that we see so many connections between Batman Year One and Batman and Robin Year One. Sammy is clearly doing this on purpose. But I like the way that's set up. The scowly, as you said, disgruntled look on Dick's face. My first thought was, is he trying to look tough or is he really upset? And I think based on the theme that we get in this issue, he's really upset. But yeah. I just thought it's funny.
And we'll find out why he's upset at the end of this issue. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's probably not the reason you think.
No, it's probably not. You might think it's because Batman's being a hard ass. Mentor, but it's really not. So Batman and Robin Year One, Chapter Four. The co-plot was by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. Writer was Mark Waid. Artist was Chris Samnee. Colorist was Matthias Lopez. Letterer was Clayton Cowles with Chris Samnee. Senior editor, Andrew Marino. Group editor, Rob Levin. Batman created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger, of course.
Especially Bill Finger.
Should be the other way around. But anyway, Robin dives in to save Batman after last issue's cliffhanger, where Batman went off the side of the boat with a big cargo, giant cargo hold pulling him down. But the Dark Knight has already grabbed a piece of rebar to pry the large crate, pinning his leg to the sea floor. Robin's flashlight proves useful, but when the heroes surface, Batman admonishes his partner for endangering his life. Batman apologizes, frustrated by the new mobster evading them at every turn. But the Boy Wonder reminds him they do know his name, Grimaldi. General Grimaldi takes his wheelchair-bound father for a rooftop stroll. He tells the elder crime boss that his loud and reckless methods were the reason he never conquered their native Miami. Grimaldi's military training and service taught him the art of discretion, and that is how he will rise to power in Gotham. The general pushes the front wheels of his father's chair off the roof edge, but pulls him back. He wants him to live to see his son do what he couldn't. Grimaldi's lieutenant informs him of the incident on the boat and how Two-Face told Batman his name. The next morning, social worker Laura Lynn plays an unexpected call on Wayne Manor. Alfred is able to alert Batman and Robin as they return to the Batcave. Bruce feigns being occupied with a workout, while after much coercion, Dick pretends to have just woken up. Lynn is worried about Dick's apparent lack of sleep and insists he get plenty that night. As she leaves, an anguished Dick realizes why he needs more sleep. Tomorrow is the first day of school.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Good Lord, no! That night, Grimaldi's men receive a crate. Inside are dozens of bats, and in Grimaldi's office, Batman appears from the shadows. The Dark Knight lets Grimaldi know that he knows of his role in U.S. Army intelligence and how he was dishonorably discharged after embezzling funds meant for foreign allies. The Caped Crusader warns him to get out of his town tonight, but Grimaldi presses a silent alarm, alerting his goons. Batman wades through them and places call devices on them, which sicks the bats on them. He escapes via a hang glider, and the next morning, Alfred drops Dick off at his first day of school. So what did you think of this one?
I continue to love this series. It's a ton of fun. Visually, I can't get enough of Chris Samnee's art. The story, we're continuing this parallel threat. There's a new gangster in town that's trying to take over. How much of a threat is he going to be to Batman? Well, maybe not as much of a threat as child welfare services and everything. Because social service, they're like, did we know you were having a surprise inspection? It's like, nope, that's the point of a surprise inspection. So the way they have to scramble to fool her. We see that, she's no dummy, and I will get to that as we kind of go through the story, the cliffhanger, it's like, oh my gosh, Dick Grayson has to go to a school like a normal boy who didn't grow up in the circus.
Yeah. It's such a great, and Mark Waid's always been great at capturing young characters, going back to the Flash and his Flash Year One, and then Impulse, of course.
Right.
So he's really great at nailing the voice of Dick as he deals with this. So yeah, it's Yeah, both stories are just as it's just like the best days of Spider-Man, the Lee Ditko, Lee Romita. You're honestly just as invested in the civilian part of the story as you are the superhero part. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. and I love the first few silent pages,
yes.
Especially the panels colored in red from Robin's flashlight. It's really sharp.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And I appreciate the fact that Rob, there's no possible way for Robin to physically help Batman out of this jam. Like, he's like being crushed by like this thing. Robin's not going to turn into like Bruce Banner and get this sudden surge of adrenaline that helps him lift this thing. That's not going to fly. But Robin's presence there with the light shows Batman that piece of metal that he's going to use to give himself leverage. And he kind of mentions that at top when they both kind of surface and they're catching their breath. And he's like, you could have, Batman's like, what were you doing? You could have drowned going down that way. Cause Batman has to signal him. He points to the top. He's like, go get yourself air before you die. And Robin's like, I could have helped you. And he's like, the flashlight was helpful. And he's like willing to concede that. And then when he's just like, I'm sorry, I was just frustrated by what's going on. So.
Yeah. I love that Batman actually apologizes mm-hmm. for being short with Robin. He's trying to be understanding since Dick is just a kid and he's new to this whole mentoring thing. He's not All-Star Batman or another psycho version of that character, you know? So I really appreciate that. I do wonder though, why didn't they both pop in the rebreathers? You know, I mean, Batman didn't have time to, but Robin could have popped his in. Yeah, they always have those things. Why didn't they pop him in? You know, Robin pop his in to go down there and help him. You know, it's like, you know, that was like, don't they have those? They always have those in their utility belts, you know? So
maybe the day after this is when they start keeping those in their belts. It's like Batman made a note as soon as they get to the cave. It's like, all right, we need to add this to our inventory.
Yeah, maybe. You're right. You know, especially with all the gas bombs we carry, you know, or something like that. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah. So, and then the next sequence, the sequence with Grimaldi and his father on the roof, that is one of the most memorable in the series for me. I remember reading that going, oh man, is he going to push this old dude off the top of this skyscraper? I mean, the look Samney puts on both of their faces just says volumes about them and their very, very strained relationship.
Yeah, my note was, I don't think this guy really cares for his dad that much.
Yeah.
And yeah, just like wheeling his, you know, incapacitated father to the edge of the thing, putting the wheel on the very edge and having the strength to like hold him up. And just the shot where he kind of like his dad is looking down, sweating as he just kind of sees the glimpse of the city below. And he's completely powerless, can't move, can't talk, can't like cry out for help.
Yeah.
And this whole time, Grimaldi has been monologuing about like his plans and everything like that, and how ineffectual his dad was, and how much he hates him for sending him to military school. But hey, this is what you got by sending me to the military. I became a general, and now I'm going to lead this thing. And then just like that fear, and then when he pulls him back, he's like, "Just so you know," like the threat of, "Just so you know, you're only alive as long as I want you to be alive." So
right, and I just, you know, the parallel. That he's one of the reasons he hates his father is because he sent him off to military school. And what's Batman doing to Robin in this issue? He's sending him off to school, you know?
Yeah, good catch, yeah.
Yeah, then we get that. I love Lauren Lynn is like, you know, she might be the scariest villain Batman's ever come up against. Because I love that, you know, Alfred like hits a button that puts the... They must have recording devices in the manor that go down into the cave because they can hear the conversation. And Batman's like pulling his cowl off. And it just, you can see Bruce Wayne's face. And he's just like, run, you know, to Robin. I mean, and it's like, I don't think I've ever seen Batman any more scared than he is right now. Right. The Joker, Bane, yeah, Ra's al Ghul. No, not as scary as Laura Lynn. Social worker, you know.
They nearly drown in the middle of the ocean, but now he's kind of desperate.
Right, yeah. And I love Alfred's trying to, you know, Dick's already got his clothes on And he's like, here, put your pajamas on. And he's like, I already put my clothes on. He's like, oh, dear God, I'm begging you for one tiny crumb of trust. You know, he's just, and he's sweating. I love, yeah. Even Alfred's getting flustered, which is, you know, fun to see. So,
but I love the moment before that when Laura's on the chair just kind of waiting. Bruce comes in as if he was just working out. And he's like, oh, yeah, go tell Dick that we have company. He's like, he probably didn't hear the doorbell. You know what a late riser he is. And just this close-up of her going, she's like, why? How has he been spending his nights? It's like, she's sharp. She's sharp. I mean, there's no reason for her to suspect Batman and Robin, but she's like, she picks up on that. She's like, what are you doing with this kid that would make him sleep in late?
Right, yeah, yeah. And I love that, you know, Dick, she's talking to Dick, and it, he's like, you know, Bruce is a good teacher. Well, really, what are you learning? A ton about Gotham City. Do you know that the crime rate here, what the crime rate here is? And Bruce, like, coughs off panel. And Dick is just, I love that Dick, he's playing along with them, but he can't help but just be a little bit of a little shit.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, he's like, he's pushing it, you know, which I'm like, and I love the, just like we've mentioned before, when she's looking away, the looks that Alfred and Bruce give him, like, you know, they could just, like, stare, you know, if they were Superman, they'd, like, keep Vision his head off, you know? I mean, it's hilarious. Like,
help us out a little bit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. yeah.
And then, yeah, that's the, like, when they get her to leave the village, he's like, why do I have to get up early tomorrow? And then you just see, she's getting in her car, and you see his word balloon from inside the house so loud that she can hear it going, school?
yeah, I would guess, like, you know, I don't know, a circus kid, yeah, how do they, you know, who supervises that, especially where they're crossing state lines constantly? You know, it's like, you know, if you're an actor in Hollywood, they've got all that set up, you know, and I mean, even I'm sure in, like, you know, now Atlanta and everything. Well, I mean, they filmed Stranger Things there. They had to, you know, right? Because, I mean, so they had to have all that set up for those kids, you know. But it's like, if you're a circus kid, did you ever really take any school? I mean, I don't know, you know.
I don't think it was a priority in the 1930s. I don't think anybody cared.
No, I mean, you know, my dad, you know, he was like, when he's like, you know, got to eighth grade, they're like, yeah, we need you on the farm. Don't go to high school. You know, he had to get his GED when he was in, you know, in the army, you know, so it's like that kind of attitude, you know, so yeah, definitely not. No.
Yeah. Backing up really, really quick to the scene before the scene with Grimaldi, when he's leaving the conversation with his dad, when they're going down the elevator, he's talking to one of his goons and he says, how was the meeting? Referring to that scene on the ship. And his goon goes, the Maronis didn't even know I was there. I'm assuming this is Clayface, and I'm assuming he means that because he was disguised, like they didn't recognize. But, like, this is the guy that he's always kind of talking to. So I'm assuming this is Clayface, is his agent in the scene.
Good point. I did not catch that. You're probably right. Yeah, that's a good catch. That's a very good catch, yeah. Then we get the scene where Grimaldi's men receive a crate that says it's from Miami, so they're assuming it's from their, you know, operations there. And they open it up, and it's full of bats that go flying everywhere.
just a crate full of bats.
Which, I mean, how humane is that for the bats? I don't know. You know, I hope there were air holes and food in there for the bats. You know, I hope Batman's not, you know, I hope PETA's not coming after Batman for mistreating his bats. You know, I hope not. But it's great. And I love that, you know, Batman just appears out of the shadows in Grimaldi's headquarters. And he really rattles him more than just appearing there. He questions his service, basically, which I think is a great move. I mean, Batman basically, you know, he tries to say, did you ever serve your country? And he's like, no, but I know enough to, you know that, you know, you're, you know, a disgrace to the uniform. I was just like, wow, okay, wow. That hit him where he lives, you know, so.
Yeah, he's making it personal, so. And
yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
Hoping that he'll slip up and make some mistakes, but
and the we get a little, you know, of course he calls his men, and I like the bit that we get these little, like, you know, Batman carries pogs in his utility belt.
Yeah.
That he, you know, Batman's back in pog form.
And I was just thinking of that quote.
And he sticks them all over the goons, and that's what calls the bats to him.
It's, yeah, they're like, he's like, homing beacons for the bats, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, it's like he's just going plop, 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 going through, and they're all like bats attacking him. That's hilarious. I love it. They do. They look like bat. They look like bat pogs, you know, like the Nightfall pogs that were out in the 90s, you know. I do like too that, you know, Grimaldi takes the blame for letting Batman get into their stronghold. He said, you know, this is on me. It's like he's like, I'm not going to kill any of you guys today over this. This is my fault, you know. So
yeah. Yeah, that's a good leader. That's, you know, not just executing everybody for his failures, because
right. Yeah.
And then yeah, just a wonderful, like at the end when he's pouring himself a drink and he's like, he's like, yeah, because he's like, I underestimated the Batman in this one. He's like, that you were unable to contain him is not a surprise. And as he's saying this, it's kind of like you get his voice over talking to his men as we see Alfred bringing Dick to school. And just that last page, you hear Grimaldi's voice saying, if a man is determined enough, there is no prison on earth that can hold him. Juxtaposed with Robin's or Dick's prison being a school. And it's like, all right, this is set up for something climactic. I'm loving this. So.
Yeah, and I love that Dick is dressed in his classic white shirt and red, red or orange sweater,
yep.
Which is, you know, like Dick Sprang, you know, yep. and Burt Ward. I mean, Burt Ward, that's almost what he always wore as Dick Grayson. So that was a nice touch. Yeah. Yeah, this was another great issue. I enjoyed this as I read it to begin with, but I'm just having a kick rereading it as we cover this. And if you guys can't tell, we really, really like this series. We, you know, so yeah, go out and get that trade that unfortunately, or is it a hardcover? Is it a hardcover now or is it a trade?
It might be already available in both. And I was just going to say, like, the only way I could like this issue more is if I had it in a collection, but my family doesn't love me that much. So.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this needs to be put in what are the digest size, the smaller books that DC's got now?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I was talking to Steve and Beth that own the LCS I go to, Heroes Realm, in Lexington, Kentucky, and we're friends with them. We always talk to them. We go in, and he said they sell like hotcakes. They can't keep them in, those books. They just, and he said right now DC's just killing it. The DC stuff is selling, the absolute stuff they can't even, they sell out of it as soon as it comes in, and they sell the heck out of the DC Finest and those smaller, compact manga size trades. You know, they sell them to death. Yeah,
I see more of those the digest, the manga sized ones. I see more of those in stores than I see the DC Finest ones.
Yeah, me too.
Like especially like bookstore, Barnes and Noble type of things. Like ever, we're like, yeah, those are big. Like I over Christmas, I went to my old LCS and they had a ton of the DC Finest. They didn't have any DC Finest in stock, but they had a ton of the other ones, the little white ones. So
yeah, and they've got a display right up by the counter of them. And it, yeah, Rob, they have a display. I know I mentioned that before, but yeah, Rob's like, I want that display. But it's up there in the front. I mean, you know, I feel like this deserves to be in that. You know, like I hope they do that down the line too. So
this strikes me as a series that will get reprinted a ton in every different format that they can. Like this one isn't going away anytime, and we're doing our part.
Right. I hope they do an absolute edition. I hope they do the artist edition. That's all the black and white art plus sketches and all that stuff. And I might buy that, you know, so.
There's a point that I meant to bring up last month, or sorry, 2 months ago when we were talking about issue 3, and I keep forgetting this night, and I was almost going to do it, but I had to bring it up now. Because we talked a little bit about the continuity of where this book kind of fits in. Because if this is like year two or year three, like the Batcave is riddled with riddled, as no pun intended, but it's full of the trophies. He's like already met all of his villains at this point. His rogues gallery is established by the time Robin walks in the door. And is that kind of what timeline does that fit in? And the thing that I was kind of thinking about is, in as much as it fits in with a Batman Year One, is this kind of in the same realm or same continuity as the Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale Long Halloween books? Like Long Halloween, like Dark Victory ends with Batman swearing Dick in as Robin. But by that point, he has faced Joker, Two-Face, Riddler, Scarecrow, Mad Hatter, Catwoman, Solomon Grundy. Like, in just a short amount of time, in that book, in those books' continuity, he did meet all of his rogues before he got Robin. So
yeah,
if this kind of took place after Dark Victory, I can kind of see that working.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Yeah, and I think DC loves that. You know, I mean, there's, you know... reading that Marshall Rogers book, it's like, you know, you get from Marshall Rogers and Steve Englehart and Terry Austin, different interviews with them over the years, that there were some people at DC that loved their run on Batman. There were some people that didn't like back then that everybody started to say, oh, this is the Englehart Rogers Batman. They didn't want that back then. They didn't want creators associated that heavily with a character. And there were people in the DC office that just flat hated Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin's art because it didn't look like other DC art. So when DC embraces something, they embrace it, you know, and I think they fully embraced everything Jeff Loeb did, even though I'm not the hugest fan of, I think Jeff Loeb always has trouble sticking a landing in just about everything I've ever read that he's written, in my opinion. I really do. I mean, Long Halloween, it just like the ending kind of falls apart for me. Maybe I'm being too critical. I mean, I like his stuff fine, but I sometimes feel like it's overpraised. But I think a lot of times it's because he's with artists that people really like too. You know, he's with Jim Lee, he's with Ed McGuinness, he's with Tim Sale, even though Tim Sale's, again, I know guys, I always say this, but he's not my particular cup of tea, but I recognize he's a great artist and he's popular. You know, so I don't know, but it's like, but Dark Victory, yeah, this could very well, not to get off on that point, but this could very well be in that continuity because it is popular, it is evergreen, and they keep it in print. So, yeah.
Alrighty, anything else?
Nope, that's all I got this month.
All right. Folks, we will be back in February to cover the next part of the Hot House story with Poison Ivy and issue 5 of Batman and Robin Year 1. Looking forward to, and then that is our penultimate issue before Batman Nightcast episode 50. Can you believe it, Chris? Only took us like 7 or 8 years to get that far.
Hey, we got it out. We got it out before the Batman part 2 come out though. So, you know, so we'll, well, we haven't yet, but I think we will. I think we will. I think we'll have it out before it even starts filming, probably, so.
I actually undercounted. It's been more than 8 years, I think, at this point.
Oh, yeah, has it? Okay.
It's been less than 10 years, and that's important.
Right, exactly, because we didn't start it when the network started, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, that's true, yeah. And it's like, you know, how long did it take me and Cindy to get through all of JLU? And we still haven't done the final episode yet as you listen to this. We're working on it. The recap, the whole thing. We're working on it. But, you know, yeah, it's funny how that had happened. Of course, we took quite a big hiatus. You know, a whole other show moved into our feed, you know, so... I think we're like one of those revived TV series that came back after, you know, 20 years and in podcast time versus TV time, but pretty much
Nightcast, the reunion.
Yeah, exactly. We're like the you know, but we actually brought all the cast back, you know, so it's
I think I'm going to start changing the narrative. I'm going to start acting like Sean and Paul stole our show. They hijacked our show from us.
We were tied up in the basement and gagged.
They didn't let us do Nightcast while they were doing their show. Yeah,
yeah, they were literally holding their arms out and our heads were, and we were like, you know, running and in running position the whole time, yeah, while they were recording, yeah.
Damn them.
When I woke up this morning, you were on my mind.
All right, folks. Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com, You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening.